Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the business of death and the death of bananas. Those are different stories, by the way. Ukraine, of course, and healthcare as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 6th of March. Good as always to have you with us. You can say this for the President of the United States. He knows how to stay on message. Last Friday, you'll recall he said there would be costs to the Russians for what's going on in Ukraine. Today, he carried through in a way.
This morning, I signed an executive order that authorizes sanctions on individuals and entities responsible for violating the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine.
Although White House officials say there is no actual list of people to be sanctioned yet, but wait, there's more.
According to my guidance, the State Department has also put in place restrictions on the travel of certain individuals and officials.
Which gets us back to his point about costs.
These decisions continue our efforts to impose a cost on Russia and those responsible for the situation in Crimea.
Here's another way to impose cost. You could let the market do it. Supporters of America's natural gas boom say the fracking revolution in this country can cut energy prices, create jobs, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, all sorts of positives. Now they're adding another one. It could help undercut Vladimir Putin. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner gets us going today.
Natural gas producers have been pressing the Obama administration for several years to let them export liquefied natural gas. It's been slow going, they say. But now, thanks to Vladimir Putin, the industry's export dreams are getting a boost. Phil Flynn is a senior market analyst at the Price Futures Group. He says right now Russia uses natural gas as a political weapon.
We don't like what you're doing politically. We're going to cut off your gas supplies. If we don't like what you're doing, we're going to double your prices.
Enter the United States, a country now on track to overtake Russia as the world's number one natural gas producer. Bill Cooper, president of an LNG trade group, says Ukraine gets about 70% of its natural gas from Russia, Europe about a third. He says they need more choices.
And we need to be ready to be able to use our natural resources as a geopolitical tool to help support our allies.
And that's something the U.S. couldn't have imagined not that long ago. Remember when we thought we were running out of natural gas? Andrew Holland is a senior fellow at the American Security Project.
2006, 2007, the Bush administration was actively engaged in a push to create LNG import facilities in the United States because we thought we were going to be an importer of natural gas.
And now, says Phil Flynn,
we now became like the Saudi Arabia of natural gas supplies.
But energy analysts warn that approving natural gas exports from the U.S. is a long-term geopolitical strategy, not a quick fix. Andrew Holland.
This is not something that we can just approve a permit today and then the ships can sail tomorrow full of LNG.
Holland says it'll take several more years before they can build all the export terminals and pipelines needed. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We went out yesterday on news of yet another delay in the Affordable Care Act. People enrolled in plans that don't meet the law's stricter coverage requirements can keep those plans for another 2 years. That could potentially buy Democrats some political cover in the coming midterm elections. But the question, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports, is who's going to pick up the tab for that?
Whether consumers end up paying for what is widely seen as a political move by the Democrats could depend on where you live. Former Senator Ben Nelson, who now heads the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, says states will get to decide whether to go ahead with plans that don't comply with the ACA.
Creating two tiers of plans, for example, the compliant and non-compliant, could result in higher premiums overall.
The people in the non-compliant plans tend to be healthier. Not having them in the exchange pool means insurers may have to shell out more money. How much more money might that cost people on the exchanges? Nelson says it's too soon to pin down a figure, but he knows insurers can't afford to take a bath even as they try to court new customers.
At some point, I think insurers take a look at their solvency risk and are not going to give away coverage, no matter how attractive it might be to gain a market.
But health economists like Christine Eibner from RAND are skeptical the decision will have much impact on consumers at all.
You know, premiums we estimate go up by only about 1%.
Eibner bases that estimate on the fact that very few people are actually staying in these health plans that don't meet the new ACA requirements. Historically, she says, individual and small group markets kick people off like bucking broncos.
There's a lot of volatility in that market. People leave that market all the time. And once you've left the market, then you lose access to your non-compliant plan.
What Eibner, insurers, and policy people don't know today is what will happen to the some 1.5 million people who've stayed in their old non-ACA compliant plans. Even if many do stay and premiums shoot up, there may be a silver lining here, at least for individual consumers, says Commonwealth Fund economist Sarah Collins.
So if you are getting a tax credit this year and your income doesn't change, it likely means that your premium won't change either, even if the premium rises next year.
Collins says what people buying health insurance on the exchanges must remember is this. If you're eligible for subsidy on the exchange, you'll never have to spend more than 9.5% of your income on a policy. That means if there are crazy premium spikes, Uncle Sam picks up the difference, not you. I'm Dan Gorenstein. For Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, whatevs, you know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You put them on your cereal, you have them just plain, you can bake them in bread. They're really good with peanut butter on them or with chocolate in milkshakes and smoothies, too. But bananas, I am sorry to have to tell you, are doomed. I learned that when I read Gwen Guilford's article about them in Quartz. Gwen, it's good to have you on.
Good to be here.
I don't want to be alarmist as we get going, and yes, it may well be a long way off, but bananas are going to go away at some point, bananas as we know them.
Yes, it certainly looks that way.
All right, explain this disease, tropical race, whatever it is.
Yeah, the disease itself is called Panama disease, and the strain that we're dealing with now is called Tropical Race 4, which is sort of menacing. But it's been around since the 1990s, and it's been in Asia, mainly Southeast Asia, and that's been fine because a lot of the export production, around 70% is in Latin America. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no one's been sweating it that much. But then last year, it showed up in Mozambique and Jordan.
As we get down into Latin America, and you know, as you were just talking about, it's developing economies that rely on bananas, not only as a domestic crop, but also in some cases for subsistence and just straight calories. I mean, it's a big deal in some of these developing countries if the banana industry has big problems.
Something like 400 million people in developing countries rely on bananas for around 20% of their daily calories. And, you know, this is an extraordinary range of bananas. It's not just, you know, those big yellow ones you see in the grocery store.
Oh, really?
They always look the same. Yes, that's the Cavendish cultivar. Only about 40% of the bananas produced around the world are Cavendishes. Hmm. The worrying thing is that 85% of global output is vulnerable to Tropical Race 4.
Let me frame that, right? And this is from your article. You just said 85% of global crop is vulnerable, and it's the world's fourth most valuable crop, bananas are.
Yeah, it's an incredibly valuable crop, and we're incredibly reliant on it. So the scale of mm-hmm. what could happen as Tropical Race 4 spreads is pretty worrisome.
I got one word for you here. It is monoculture, this thing that we do where we in big ag find something that works and we farm it exclusively, right? And then it becomes vulnerable and all that. Is that where we are here with this?
The trade-off for getting cheap food in a convenient, reliable way in the way that we've been doing for more than a century now is that we have a tremendous loss of biodiversity. And that's dangerous for a couple of reasons. First off, that when you have that focus on a single cultivar mm-hmm. to the exclusion of others, limiting the genetic diversity makes your crop more vulnerable to pests and disease. And then when you're overly reliant on that single crop, it compounds the risk of something really calamitous happening in the event of a crop failure.
Do we have, and I don't even know if this is a legitimately scientific term, do we have a backup banana?
The one we're eating now, the Cavendish, that was, you know, the backup banana for the Big Mike.
Wow.
Because it is resistant to Panama Race 1. So we don't really have one. People are working on it. It's really hard to develop bananas. And people are also working on genetically modified bananas, which means using non-banana genes too. Develop those.
Gwen Guilford, she's a reporter at Quartz. Gwen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
They were counting on what they call a golden age of death when the boomers all began to drop off the earth.
Keeping the funeral business alive. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 61 points today, about a 3%, finished at 16,421. The NASDAQ down 5 points, a 10%, 4,352. The S&P 500 ticked up 3 points, a 10%, 1,877. Costco pulled 2.75% off the shelves today with an unexpectedly large drop in profits. Kroger was discounted 0.7% despite strong quarterly returns. Walgreens dispensed with 2.5%. The drug retailer missed expectations a bit, using bad winter weather as the reason. Gosh, can't imagine why. Pandora shuffled down 5.5%. Its total listener hours dipped a bit this past February. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for February. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue consumer credit data for January. And if snakes are your thing, and why wouldn't they be, Sweetwater, Texas hosts its annual Rattlesnake Roundup, billed as the world's largest. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's been no shortage of low-level but nonetheless lousy corporate news this week. Radio Shack is going to close a bunch of stores. Today we learned Sbarro, the fast food chain, am I saying that right, Sbarro, is getting set to file for bankruptcy protection. And Staples is going to close 225 stores over the next 2 years to save $500 million because the office supply business just ain't what it used to be. Sally Herships has that story.
What is going on at Staples? Is our love affair with the Post-it note over? Is paper finally dead?
We're not using as much office products anymore, and we're seeing increasing competition from online retailers.
Liang Feng is an equity analyst at Morningstar. He says technology is somewhat to blame.
Now that we have mobility devices, people don't need to purchase as many pens, paper, ink as they did before.
So while our love for stationery products isn't gone, it is spread thin. And Feng says when consumers do shop, they often go to Staples competitors like Costco or Amazon, which means other office supply stores are having problems too. David McGoldrick is a researcher with Euromonitor International.
It's not actually really a problem with them in particular. It's more of the overall business environment that they're in.
Like the recent polar vortex. Bad weather equals bad sales. McGoldrick says one way Staples is dealing with these problems is by relocating to smaller stores.
These stores have much less overhead and they're cheaper to run, so that even with the decreased product selection, Staples is able to make a better profit per store.
And Staples is expanding its business-to-business products. Scott Tillman is an analyst with B. Riley.
Think snacks, sodas, water, facilities, think cleaning supplies.
And even safety goggles for warehouse workers or medical supplies, because Tillman says Staples sells to a lot of medical and dental offices. Morningstar's Liang Feng says closing stores never looks good, but Staples isn't in bad shape.
Staples has actually outperformed the other office product retailers for quite a long time.
But Fung says business-to-business sales are lower margin. So he says, while we can expect staples to stick around, it could struggle to grow. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We've talked at least a couple of times on the program, probably more, honestly, about high-frequency trading, that part of the apparatus that we call Wall Street, where firms use supercharged computers to trade unbelievably fast, millions of shares in a fraction of a second fast. The technology and tactics of high-frequency trading are impressive to some, but controversial to others, which is why a lot of companies that do it don't like to talk about it. Marketplace's Mark Garrison takes us on a rare visit inside.
There's a couple of our trading teams here. We have our compliance.
Founder Mark Gorton is showing us around Tower Research Capital. It has a Wall Street sounding name, but its Tribeca offices look more like the world's most well-decorated yoga studio. There are all these Buddhas, Asian statues, and huge plants throughout. Like nearly everyone, the boss is in jeans.
I don't think most people that wear suits are happy to wear suits. I mean, on weekends, they don't wear suits.
He wears shorts when it's warm and cycles to work. He puts a fair amount of his money into fighting for bike lanes. Gorton says old school bankers who visit seem to want to walk in his casual shoes.
They're kind of jealous a little bit.
Unlike a bank, employees don't have to meet clients, so business attire is pointless. But it's more about the employees Gorton needs to win over. He's not looking for traditional bankers and traders. He hires mostly engineers and scientists.
The market that we're in is really competing for programmers, which is a very, very competitive market. And we're competing against Google, who has very nice offices and lots of food.
Every day at lunchtime, waves of meals brought by the company arrive in paper and plastic bags. The fashionable young receptionist becomes traffic cop, directing delivery guys to place them in neat rows. She messages employees when their nourishment arrives. There are also several kitchens, all overflowing with free snacks and drinks.
In the software industry, it's pretty much expected that you're going to provide stuff like this these days.
High-frequency traders largely see their work as tech first and finance second. Companies like Tower rely on young recruits like Eddie Ferreira, who studied computer science at Princeton. That's a storied hunting ground for Wall Street's biggest banks, but he wanted a different environment and more challenging work.
I really don't see myself working at that new grad analyst job, signing your life away for a couple of years, basically doing work that, you know, some would call it menial. At best, it's repetitive.
He's a trader at Tower, but there's no trading floor like you may imagine. There isn't even that staple of Wall Street workspaces, a television locked on CNBC. It's too slow. Trades are made by computers in the blink of an eye, launched by algorithms Ferreira and his colleagues create beforehand. Their programs may net only fractions of a penny on an individual share, but with their turbocharged computers trading at enormous volume, it adds up.
Even as we're talking, we're transacting in hundreds of thousands or millions of shares.
Uptown from Tower is another high-frequency firm, Global Trading Systems. CEO Ari Rubenstein used to scream his trades in a hectic commodities pit. This tranquil office is worlds away.
We'll probably trade 3.5% of the U.S. cash equity markets by the end of the day. To trade that percentage of the market, 20 years ago, you would need a whole building full of people, and there would be paperwork and all this. Now there's four guys here, and they build technologies that can handle all of the back office in an automated fashion.
Like Tower, Rubenstein's hires have backgrounds in everything but finance, from physics to engineering to math to video games, where T-shirt-clad senior developer Jeff Connect used to work. He did not expect to wind up on Wall Street.
My parents were like, well, you're going to have to buy a suit and go to work, but here it's great. I would have never thought something like this existed.
Staffers like him are right at home, blasting away at the full-size video games in the company game room. It also has a bachelor pad-style couch and foosball table. Programmers fuel up at the company's gleaming, fancy coffee machines. Rubenstein marvels at the amount of caffeine his employees put away. High-frequency trading firms like these may be small and casual compared to giant banks, but all the rapid-fire trades churning through their servers make them a force. According to Tab Group, high-frequency traders accounted for about half of all U.S. stock trading last year. That is a worrying number to speed trading's critics. They don't see the battle to make trades happen a few microseconds faster as good for the markets.
It's this arms race going on where there's no benefit
Eric Hunsader is the founder of market data firm Nanex and one of speed trading's harshest and most colorful critics. One of his issues may well involve your retirement savings. Let's say a mutual fund in your 401k wants to buy a large block of shares. If a high-frequency trader gets there first, the mutual fund will have to pay a bit more, which ultimately comes out of the retirement savings of you and many other regular Americans.
It's like a million paper cuts. Everybody's paying just a little bit more for buying and selling.
Back at Tower, Gorton disagrees. He and other high-frequency traders point to a general trend of lower trading costs.
Markets are getting squeezed to these kind of ultra levels of efficiency, which really should make everybody pretty happy.
And that's another way speed traders sound like techies. It's like the response Google and Facebook give about privacy. Don't be afraid. If you were as smart as us, you'd understand. We're making life better. As far as the big firms that manage much of America's retirement money, they don't agree on whether high-frequency trading is good or bad. Like any technology, it could help, but could cause problems. Even high-frequency traders worry about someone smarter and faster taking them out.
This is not the sort of business I could bequeath to my kids. At some point along the way, we're going to miss some turn in technology, and all the good work we've done will not be enough.
But for now, his firm and other high-speed traders are a reality and an oddity in finance, where high-tech reigns and old Wall Street seems far, far away. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
What was it John Maynard Keynes said? Not the bit about economics being a dangerous science or that markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. No, I'm thinking here of that bit about how in the long run, we're all dead. That, as Keynes himself would acknowledge, is a business opportunity, but the business of death is changing as society changes. That's the crux of a piece that Sandy Hingston wrote for Philadelphia Magazine not too long ago. It's called The Death of the Funeral Business. Sandy, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here, Kai.
What is it about the business of death that makes us uncomfortable? I mean, you point out, actually, that funeral homes and that entire industry, it's really the business of distraction, right?
Yeah, they're helping us through a transition. When someone in our lives dies, it creates a hole in the social fabric, and we have to wait and work to fill that hole in. And one of the jobs of a funeral director is to help us do that by giving us stuff to think about, you know. What dress do you want the deceased to wear? Does this hair look good? These really don't have anything to do with the big questions of life and death and the hereafter. They are distractions.
And it's a series of distractions that are facilitated by ritual. And that's, I guess, the theme of your piece, how those rituals are changing.
Yeah. One of the funeral directors that I spoke to with the piece said it's always been about telling the person's story. The change that we're seeing now, well, a couple of changes. One is that the rate of cremation has gone up incredibly. Mm. It's gone up by 20% in the past 20 years. And part of that is driven by economics. It's much cheaper to be cremated Right. than to be buried with a traditional, you know, all the frills funeral. But I think it also has to do with the change is sort of from being part of this larger religious framework where you're just one part of Christianity, for example, to I'm me, I'm an individual. Hmm. You're celebrating your personal life here on earth rather than your move from earth to the hereafter.
And as you point out, we are becoming, and this is not you pointing it out, I mean, surveys show we are becoming a less religious society. And so if we are less concerned with the hereafter, then that's bad for the funeral business.
It's very bad for the funeral business. If you take into account that it costs about four times as much to have that full frills funeral, you'd have to have a lot more people die just for funeral homes to break even. Hmm. They were counting on what they call a golden age of death when the boomers Ooh. All began to drop off the earth.
Darn those boomers again, man. It's all the boomers' fault.
But we're hanging on. We're hanging on. And we're also wanting that less expensive cremation. So there would have to be some really major trend shifts.
And you go to the other end of the generational spectrum as well, and you point out that millennials – you know, they're going to change jobs every 3 years and they don't know what they want to do tomorrow, let alone in 20 years. And so the idea of being planted in one place for eternity is simply not a selling point.
Or even having mom planted in one place for eternity. What a drag. Who's going to go back on Memorial Day and Mother's Day and tend to that grave? People don't do that anymore. People used to treat cemeteries like parks. You would pack a picnic lunch and go hang out with mom. I don't see my age or anybody younger ever doing that again. So you have sort of these dead zones, literally, yeah. These places nobody goes except when they have to for a funeral. Mm.
Does it matter for the business of death where we die? You know, I mean, people used to die at home in their beds, and now increasingly it's hospitals and intensive care units.
That's one of the most interesting things to think about. When Abraham Lincoln was shot and they carried him across the street into that house and the room where he was packed with people, they were there because they knew he was going to die and they wanted to watch. When you were on your deathbed, your friends and relations used to gather, and it was so that they could be there and observe that moment of transition when you passed from this world into the next world. Granted, they didn't, you know, have TV. It wasn't.
So they had nothing else to do? What?
But it was considered momentous, that passage. It was, you know, the most important thing that was going to happen to you in your life. And we've lost that sense of momentousness, I think. We don't have that sense of oneness with a hometown or with a church or with a community that we once had.
Sandy Hingston. She's a writer for Philadelphia Magazine. Sandy, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which one is reminded of O.J. Simpson and the White Bronco. This morning, Newsweek revealed the identity of the guy who they say invented Bitcoin. His name is Satoshi Nakamoto, which everybody had foolishly thought was just a pseudonym for the guy who invented Bitcoin. It turns out he lives in an L.A. suburb called Temple City. That is, the guy who might have changed money as we know it lives in Southern California. But that's not the crazy part. The crazy part is that the media has been chasing him all over town in a Prius today. One stop was at the Associated Press Bureau here in Los Angeles, right next to Marketplace World Headquarters. So that is our brush with fame. It's all over now, but apparently there was a sushi lunch involved as well at some point. So there you go. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hearst, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. Coming up tomorrow, a special broadcast, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Global Economy. It's the Cold War, minus the nukes, kind of. I'm Kai Rosdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.